Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Faith Focus Weekly Discipleship Podcast. My name is Kevin Rognes, and I'm the Discipleship Director here at Faith Covenant Church. I just want to thank you for watching or listening today and remind you to make sure you subscribe and leave a review. You subscribe so that you don't miss any of our weekly episodes, and leaving a review helps us to know how we're doing and what we can do to improve. So I would really appreciate if you can do those things. Right now, if you may remember, we are in the midst of a series of episodes about church history. It's so important to learn from history because we help better understand where we're coming from in our traditions today, and it also helps to learn from the mistakes of the past. The church has made mistakes in the past, and it's important that we do our best to not repeat them. To do that, we have to know our history. And that's a command that we see throughout the Bible. It's not always phrased as know your history, but in the Bible it's often phrased as understanding the law, which includes the history of the people. So it's very important that we understand where we come from. In the past couple of episodes, we talked about the earliest days of the church as it battled with persecution and those kinds of things. And then we did another episode where we talked about how the Roman Empire at the time, came to start accepting the church and how the church started to become more powerful and involved with the state. So that gets us into where we are today, which is talking about the medieval era of Christianity. And this is a really long era. So this is going to be about 1,000 years of history that we're going to skim through pretty quickly. So this is covering roughly the 4th to the 15th centuries, or the 300s to 1400s, which is actually about 1,100 years. So it's a lot to cover. We're obviously not going to go into great depth of all of it. But we're going to give a very surface-level understanding of things. So to kind of just remind us of what I'm looking at, I'm using this book called The Story of Christianity by Justo L. Gonzalez, and it's a really helpful two-volume work. This is volume one, and then we'll get into volume two in a few episodes. Really helpful background of history, but even this book is only a summary, and I'm only doing a really quick summary of a summary, so there is so much to delve into with church history. So yeah, let's go ahead and get into it. A quick reminder, before we left off last week, we talked a bit how the western part of the Roman Empire fell. They were invaded by various tribes. The eastern part of the empire continued on for about another 1,000 years, and it continued under the name of the Byzantine Empire, with Constantinople as its capital, where Constantine had been emperor. So going back to this then, to give a little bit more detail on kind of the fall of the Roman Empire, the Roman Empire basically, which was centered obviously in Rome and in Italy, what is now Italy. When I say the country names that we are familiar with today, those country names didn't exist then. When I say these names of like Italy or France, I'm meaning our modern day borders of those nations, just so that we understand some of the geography. But basically, towards the time of the end of the Roman Empire, a series of northern tribes from areas like Germany and northern France, those kinds of areas, a series of those tribes did invasions into areas like France and Spain, into Italy, kind of down into southern and western Europe. And those tribes and those wars and invasions basically left the Roman Empire in tatters. Rome got invaded and destroyed a couple of times. It was kind of messy. During all of this, church leaders, usually the bishops of their churches and sometimes the Pope, they were often willing to obey and support the rulers of the state at the time. So various kings, some of the emperors that were still kind of trying to keep the empire going. But kings were also getting involved too. So when one bishop would die, the king would often be the person who decided who the bishop would be. So it's a really interesting mix of state and church and kind of a weird relationship with that. Sometimes the religious leaders were more loyal to those kings and to those emperors than they were to the church and to the Bible. So that became problematic. When the Romans, when the Roman Empire fell and Roman peoples kind of left Great Britain, the area that we know as England today or the UK, a lot of pagan tribes like the Angles and the Saxons, which is what we get our Anglo-Saxon term from, those tribes took over kind of in Great Britain, but the church continued to thrive in Ireland, and Ireland became a really important center of Christianity in the area. Ireland sent missionaries up to Scotland on the northern part of the British Isles, and Christianity kind of really became entrenched there. And then missionaries came down from Scotland into the rest of Great Britain, and that's kind of how Great Britain kind of was Christianized. Another major contribution of Irish Christianity was the practice that is now very common in the Catholic Church, the practice of confessing your sins to priests. That was something that was not done as much, and in Protestant traditions it's not really done frequently, but it's very common in Catholicism and really developed with the Irish. So then, during the 5th to 8th centuries, which is the years the 400s up through the 700s, many invasions happened in Western Europe. Like I already said, those Germanic tribes from the Northern Europe. A lot of learning was destroyed. A lot of texts were destroyed. They didn't have mass production of books back then, so everything was copied by hand, so there weren't many copies of things. So a lot was destroyed, unfortunately. Paganism kind of had a return to prominence among some of these areas that were invaded, and also heretical forms of Christianity. Eventually, those things, the paganism and heretical forms of Christianity, kind of faded out because the Christianity that existed just kind of stayed popular and stayed in place as these other tribes invaded. So eventually, these forms of paganism and heretical Christianity kind of died off on their own, and people converted to Orthodox or Catholic faith, as it was known then and is kind of known now. Then in the 6th century, so the 500s, there is a monk named Benedict, and he's the guy that we get the name the Benedictine order from. He developed a new kind of monasticism, a new kind of being a monk. Prior to that, being a monk or a nun living in a monastery was usually a very personal and private thing, but with Benedict, he really helped emphasize prayer and service of others. So instead of just going to a monastery and just kind of doing your own thing and praying and just kind of being in your own little world, Benedict helped emphasize, yes, we do need to be in prayer. He had a really strict rule of prayer that he lived by, but that was to empower people to go out and serve in the communities. So that became really prominent amongst monasteries and Christian circles at the time. Those monasteries also became centers of learning, teaching centers, and eventually also evolved into hospitals and pharmacies. So this was a big development, not just theologically, but also culturally and socially as well. Another major development during this time frame was the development of the papacy, or of the Pope and the Pope's legacy. The Pope was generally the Bishop of Rome, so the leader of the church in Rome specifically, and the Pope gradually became more powerful. Rome had been, of course, the capital of the Roman Empire, so it was already a prominent city anyway, but the reason that the Pope specifically became more important was because of Jesus' words of Peter, "I'm going to build my church upon you." Peter then was regarded as the first bishop of Rome. He died there, was martyred there, we believe. And so it's believed that the church in Rome is kind of the church that is the basis for the rest of churches throughout the world. So that's when that tradition was kind of starting to really take root and really develop in that time frame as well. So as these tribes from the north were coming down south and invading, the popes for a long time were sometimes the people who were kind of like holding things together socially and culturally in many extents. They used what power they had to kind of rally the troops and try to fight off some of the invaders. And there was limited levels of success with that. So the way that they had success with that helped kind of solidify their power. To do that, the popes were often relying on support from the Byzantine Empire over in Constantinople in the eastern part of the known world at the time. But over time, that kind of gradually changed, and the Pope was able to make more local alliances with the Franks, which eventually became the French. French. So the Pope influence just kind of really continued, and as the Pope got more allied with the Franks in France, there started to be a division that developed with the church in the east, kind of based in Constantinople. So starting to see some division there take root. So by the 7th century, or the 600s roughly, it seemed like things in Western Europe were like kind of starting to settle down and kind of relax after some of these tribes had been invaded. But then there were other things going on in the world that were starting to create some interesting events. During that time, Islam was developing in the Middle East. And so Islam and governments ruled by Muslim leaders began to take over the Middle East and take over places that had previously been major centers of Christian thought. So Certainly, Jerusalem and Israel itself fell under Muslim rule, and then it spread out into northern Africa, places like Carthage, where St. Augustine came from, and then also spreading north up near Turkey. So that became a really tense point of having Muslim invaders at the very kind of southern end near Turkey, kind of up against the Byzantine Empire. But then also some armies invaded from northern Africa and got into Spain and even almost as far as France. And so there was a lot of conflict that developed out of those tensions that were happening. Muslim rule was a challenge to the Byzantine and Persian empires, and the Persian Empire actually eventually disappeared. Part of this was because there was a lot of just kind of the everyday citizens of the Persian and Byzantine empires that were really, really sick of being oppressed by those two empires. And so they had incentive to kind of put their support behind these new Muslim rulers because they thought that they would have a chance at more freedom. And so this was kind of a major upheaval to the known order of the known world around the Mediterranean at the time. So major, major changes with all of that. These were some of the areas where Christianity first thrived. Christianity, of course, was born in Jerusalem, in Israel, and that area was now taken over by Muslims. Northern Africa, that was an area where there had been a lot of really important Christian thinkers that have come out of those areas. Those areas were also taken over, and Christianity largely disappeared from those areas for a very long time, for centuries to come. So with all of this, previously, Christianity had kind of been centered on the areas immediately surrounding the Mediterranean Sea, particularly in Jerusalem in the Middle East, and then like Italy. Now, with all of these developments, the kind of axis of Christian thought kind of changed, and so it now kind of focus from Italy and then moving north through France and then into the British Isles. So that kind of line, you could say, is kind of where Christian thought now was being centered towards the end of these centuries. So obviously, Christian and Islamic theologies were often at odds with one another, which resulted in a lot of Christian thought to clarify Trinitarian doctrines. Christians do consider themselves to be a monotheistic religion. We believe in one God. that exists in three persons. And so Muslim theology really focuses on the one God part. When Muslim theology looks at Christian theology, there's conflict because Muslim theology often sees Christianity as polytheistic, as having multiple gods. That's just a difference in how the two understand each other. And so because Islam and Christianity were kind of butting heads, a lot of Christians had to do the work of, okay, how do we explain this and understand the Trinity? So a lot of our important theology comes from this time period and this particular conflict that forced people to kind of clarify these positions. So another thing to kind of speak about is the Eastern Church, the Eastern Christian Church, that was more local to the Byzantine Empire. At this point, the church was still generally the church overall. It was one church. But there were starting to be some really notable differences between the Western Church and the Eastern Church. The Eastern Church was pretty focused on speaking Greek, and the Western Church was largely speaking Latin. Eastern Christianity became eventually known as Orthodox Christianity. That's a terminology that still largely exists today. And they started to kind of develop their own traditions in some ways. A major theological controversy arose that still affects us today, and there was debate as to the extent of the divinity of Jesus versus the humanity of Jesus. Different people had different ideas, like Jesus is more human, and so God's will had to override him, or Jesus was more divine, and he was just kind of barely human. This was a major debate at the time. There was political upheaval over this. It's kind of hard for us to imagine today now, because we don't usually have that, but that was a very significant disagreement that was happening in the Eastern Church. This was largely resolved in the year 451 in the 5th century with something called the Council of Chalcedon, and the decision made by that was that Jesus was both fully human and fully divine. That's kind of a doctrine that we more or less take for granted today. But that was something that was a major dispute at that time. So it's not that after that council that everything was resolved and everything was agreed upon after that. Not the case. But that was a major turning point after which people would look back and say, no, we resolved this. This is what Christianity believes. Also, what was interesting was that the emperor of the Byzantine Empire, or various emperors, were often getting involved and weighing in on some of these councils. So you had state leaders weighing in on spiritual theological debates, which is a really interesting dynamic, and it meant sometimes that there was a non-biblical element being introduced in some of these councils. So that was an interesting dynamic that was happening. There was also in the Eastern Church major debates over the use of imagery. And this was too, again, something of a response to Muslim theology that was kind of coming into contact with Christian theology. In Muslim theology, it's very deeply forbidden to have any sorts of images because it could be seen as idol worship. And so the church, especially in the East, also began to wrestle with that, in part because there were certain monks and priests that were selling images as kind of a religious way to kind of gain entrance to heaven sort of thing. It was becoming corrupt and becoming problematic. And so there was a major debate in the 8th and 9th centuries, so the 700s to 800s in the Eastern Church, about whether or not images should be objects of worship. What they decided is, no, we should not worship the images, even if it's an image of Jesus. They didn't go as far as saying we shall not have any images at all, which is what happens in Islam, but it's okay to have images to the extent that they help teach the story of the Bible. This was in part important because we have to keep in mind during this time period, most people are not literate. And so seeing these images in that help tell the story are actually really helpful to convey the stories of the Bible. So the Eastern Church and the Western Church kind of continued on, some kind of developing their own traditions to an extent. The Eastern Church, though, really split off in the year 1054, so the 11th century, with something known as the Great Schism, kind of the Great Divide. And at the time, again, there was insistence in the East on speaking in Greek. They believed that was the ideal language, especially given that most of the New Testament was written in Greek, and there was a major translation of Hebrew text into Greek. And the church was speaking Latin. The church finally split up when they got to a kind of a dividing point about clerical celibacy. So clerical meaning leaders in the church, and celibacy meaning the not having romantic relationships, not getting married, not having sex. So the Western church at the time was saying the clergy, the clerical people, they need to be celibate. They should not be in relationships. That's kind of where the Western church was going. And the Eastern church said, no, we think it's appropriate or potentially beneficial in many cases for clergy to be able to get married if they feel led to do so. So that became kind of a breaking point, and that's when the Eastern church became kind of Eastern Orthodox and the Western church kind of split off on its own. So that's a divide that still exists today. There are still debates over that very subject of clerical celibacy. Obviously, in Protestant traditions, clerical celibacy is not something that's necessarily required. It's optional, but it's also an option to marry. That's a whole other debate that came about in the Reformation, which we'll get to in a few episodes. So that was a situation that was developing. So the Roman Empire, again, like we had said, it largely collapsed. It kind of still continued in name, sort of. It had a little bit of a revival in the year 800 when the King of France, who was known as Charles at the time, he was crowned as emperor by the Pope. So an emperor of kind of Western Europe, so like Italy, France, Germany, Spain, kind of those areas. The Pope crowned Charles as emperor, and so the empire kind of had a little bit of resurgence. It looked very different than the actual Roman Empire. It was very, it was in name similar, but it was two separate things for all intents and purposes. When King Charles of France, he was king of the Franks, but they became the French. When he became emperor, he was known as Charlemagne. You've maybe heard of him. And so that was a major turning point. It was a really important indicator that the church and the state were very much intertwined at that time. It was also a period of peace for a season. Charlemagne's empire was very united for a few decades, but by the end of the 9th century, the end of the 800s, it largely fell apart. People just kind of drifted. Kings here and there, all over the place, kind of came into power, and there was just no real unity. There was also kind of a collapse from a currency monetary system, where, which is what we have today. You know, we have dollars, and we earn our dollars, and we use our dollars to go pay for goods. They had had that at the time. We see bits and pieces of that play out in the Bible when Jesus is talking about like shekels and stuff, and like weights for gold and measures and such. That largely collapsed, and the economy moved to a barter economy, where it says, you know, I have these goods, I will trade these things for these things. So you had to have something of value to get something else of value. If you've ever played Settlers of Catan, it was kind of like that. I have a sheep, I want to trade it for a wheat. That's kind of what things moved into. Power became very decentralized after a few decades after Charlemagne's rule. There were just all these kings and feudal lords all over the place. And so it kind of became really complicated. Land, owning land, became the big marker of wealth. And so feudalism became very prominent, where a few people who owned a bunch of land and would kind of rent it out to other people, the landowners were the ones who were in charge. They were the feudal lords. So power is decentralized. Western Europe became very fragmented. There wasn't a lot of collaboration going on, I guess you could say. And the church owned a lot of land because it owned a lot of monasteries, a lot of buildings. And so the church became very powerful in many respects because it owned a lot. This did become fairly problematic because it meant that church leaders were very deeply involved in politics in ways that exposed them to corruption. In Rome in particular, the connections between the church and the state meant that the popes, in many cases, were led into very deep corruption. There's a lot of bribery. There was violence. There were seasons where there were multiple popes at one time that were all kind of saying, no, I'm the pope. I'm the pope. I'm the pope. They were going back and forth, and there was division on that, and we'll get to more of those examples as well. By the 10th century, so the 900s, Western Europe was also contending with these Muslim invasions that I've mentioned coming up through North Africa into Spain. Some of them got as far as modern-day France and modern-day Italy in some cases. And so at the same time, there were invasions coming down from Scandinavia. So you have Muslim armies coming up from the south. You have Scandinavian armies coming down from the north. So it had a lot of really challenging times for Western Europe as they were kind of being clamped in between two major forces. So here, as we're getting kind of into the 10th century, so the late 900s and early into the 11th century, things had not been going well. You know, there had been some like moments of like unity in the on the continent, and then it kind of fell apart again. So it's kind of this ebb and flow. But there was moments of renewal for different people who recognized that things are not going so well right now, so let's try to improve things. So a series of monks led various monastic renewals in France in particular, kind of centered on a monastery in Cluny, France. These were really vital renewals, and a lot of other monasteries kind of picked up on some of these changes and said, let's get back to the basics of faith. That was really important. There was a period of really emphasizing the clerical celibacy. Up until this point, the monks had been largely celibate, but now they were saying, no, the church should be celibate as well. Part of that was reacting against the corruption of having church leaders that just pass their titles and power and land on to their children. And it just kind of became a very corrupt system in some ways. So that was part of that reaction. This was controversial. It wasn't like a resolved issue by many means, but the Western church started moving towards that, and that's when they developed that conflict that we talked about earlier with the Eastern church. Some of these movements of reform kind of sputtered out because some of the monasteries kind of became victims of their own success. Different people donated so much land and wealth to these monasteries that they kind of became the thing that they had been fighting against in the sense that they had a lot of power and had a lot of holdings. So they kind of drifted away from some of their some of what originally set them apart. I talked about that. So there were sometimes various wars between kings and emperors, even some of the popes got involved with these wars. Like sometimes popes raised an army, and they would fight for power and loyalty and all these things, especially in the 11th and 12th centuries. So the 11th and 12th centuries, or the 1000s into the 1100s, were kind of just a lot of conflict between the state and the church and different kings, emperors, all kind of just kind of fighting to kind of be in charge. It was kind of all over the place. Over time, there was a truce between the church and the state. They got to a more stable place. And the church in the West, for sure, also kind of more clearly stated their desire and their doctrine for universal clerical celibacy in the Western church. In other words, church leaders had to not marry and had to not have families. So this was all kind of building up all at once. And the Pope then was really become a very powerful figure. The Pope was kind of the central authority in all this. So among all of these things, starting in the 12th century, in the 1100s, we start to get to a really, really, actually no, sorry, the 1000s, so the 11th century, very end of the 11th century, we get to the Crusades. the wars basically between Christian armies and Muslim armies. And this was a very dark chapter of Christian history. There's a lot to repent of. The goals of the Western Europe church and the Western European churches were basically the ones who were sending Christian armies. The goals were to help defend the Byzantine Empire. So the reason that the Byzantine Empire wasn't sending armies was because their armies were needed at home to defend the homeland. And so the Byzantine Empire was kind of up against Muslim armies, and so they were in conflict. And so Western Europe armies came in to help defend the Byzantine Empire. Another one of the goals was to reunite the East and Western churches. They wanted to get them back together, more for power reasons than for religious reasons. But they also wanted to reconquer the Holy Land and other areas that had previously been major Christian areas of Christian thought and missionary activity and so on. So these were horribly violent wars that deeply contradicted much of Christian faith. The First Crusade began in the year 1095, so the very end of the 11th century, and it was somewhat of a success. So Christian armies did retake Nicaea, one of the key cities where the Council of Nicaea had been decided, which is kind of in the Turkish area today. They retook Antioch, which is in modern-day Syria. That was a major missionary city. Paul traveled there. And they eventually did recapture Jerusalem as well in 1099, so at the very, very end of the 11th century. The Jerusalem siege was particularly violent. Christian armies did some horrible things during that siege and that conflict. Violence against women, sexual violence against women, even children were massacred. It was really, really violent. And some of the ways that these armies were recruited were also not very Christian at all. Like, basically, a lot of these soldiers were told, if you fight this war, you will be rewarded in heaven, which is not at all anything that's anywhere in the Bible. But that was kind of the selling point for joining the Crusades. So in some cases, the Crusades were kind of seen as armed pilgrimages. It was like, oh, here's your ticket to go see the Holy Land, but you have to kill a bunch of people to do it. So it was just very problematic on so many levels. So that First Crusade that ended in 1099 was roughly successful in the sense that they recaptured some of those territories. It wasn't a permanent victory, though. Muslim armies continued to fight back, and Muslims retook the city of Edessa in Turkey in 1144, so midway through the second century. So that's when the Second Crusade began. There was a second round of gathering armies from Western Europe and heading on over and going to war. And that Second Crusade wasn't terribly successful. In 1187, Muslim armies retook Jerusalem and took over most of the Holy Land once again. And so the Third Crusade began, and in an attempt to retake it back again, retake Jerusalem again, and that failed as well. The Fourth Crusade was also kind of largely a failure. That army was, through various circumstances, detoured and actually took over Constantinople in the Byzantine army. So Western armies of the Roman or the Western European armies actually tried to take over the Byzantine Empire, and they were kind of successful. They did briefly take over Constantinople, but then Constantinople eventually won their freedom back and became the Byzantine Empire again. But yeah, that led to even deeper Eastern-Western tensions. So now we have the Western Europe, former Roman Empire areas, in conflict with Muslim territories, and kind of now also in conflict with the Eastern Byzantine Empire. So that was problematic. So then there were two more failed crusades, the Fifth and Sixth Crusades, that pretty much failed by the year 1270, so by the end of the 13th century. And after that, that was kind of the end of the Crusades. It was largely, it was just a terrible situation. Just incredible levels of violence from both armies against each other, and created so much tension that persists to this day. We're still dealing with the ramifications of that. So really, really dark, terrible period of history in the church. The one part of that was maybe more militarily successful in the long term was the Spanish Reconquista movement, which fought against the Muslims in Spain in particular, because at this point, Muslims in Spain had been there and in power for a few centuries. So starting in 929, so the end of the, or partway through the 10th century into 1248, that's kind of when the Reconquista ended. Armies in Spain fought the Muslims out of the European mainland and pushed them back into northern Africa. So that was kind of the only part of the whole offensive against Islam and Muslim armies that was militarily successful, so to speak, was eventually over the course of a couple hundred years, pushing the Muslim armies out of the European mainland, out of Spain. So really all the Crusades really accomplished was to increase distrust between Christians and Muslims. And again, that persists until today. It increased increased distrust between Western Europe and Eastern Europe with the Byzantine Empire. You know, that was a deepening of the divisions between Eastern and Western Christians. It also increased papal authority, so the Pope became much more powerful during this time. The Pope was raising up armies and saying, go, you know, take over these lands. So there's a lot of that. And this period also reignited a lot of trade and economic growth in these areas. Suddenly you had all these soldiers and stuff going back and forth on the Mediterranean, so you had a lot of trade that went along with that, and so a lot of cities grew during that time and became more powerful, got bigger, built universities, hospitals, churches, all those kinds of things. So a lot happened during this period of the Crusades. Then as we get into the 13th century, or the 1200s roughly, this was kind of the era of, like some scholars call it peak Christianity, or the golden age of Christianity in the medieval era. It doesn't mean that it was all perfect by any means, but this was kind of the peak of Christian power and influence and authority in Western Europe, at least. One of the figures of that you've maybe heard of, he was Francis of Assisi. He was somebody that kind of helped lead a new form of monastery and a new form of being a monk. This became known as the Franciscan Order, which is still around today and still doing great work around the world. So these kinds of orders really thought it was important to live in poverty and live as simply as possible so that those resources could be better used for the betterment of other people. So that helped to lead many Franciscans become missionaries all around the world. So during this time, Franciscan orders sent missionaries to Africa, to the Middle East, to Asia. So really as far away as they could get at the time that they knew of, as much of the known world that they could get to, they were going to spread the gospel of Jesus Christ. So that was going on. It was also a high point for a movement of scholasticism, or really getting deep into study and learning. Monasteries and cathedrals led to schools and eventually universities, and so cities started to grow around these universities. So some of the oldest universities that exist in the world were started during this time. Thomas Aquinas was a key figure in all of this. He's a very well-known Christian writer who is still read and still influential today. Some of the things that he wrote during this period that are still read today include his highly influential systematic theology, and he also was really an important figure in helping the church understand some of the new philosophical trends that were happening in the world. So as these new philosophies kind of came up, and some people in the church kind of went, whoa, this is bad, is this bad, what do we do with this? Thomas Aquinas helped the church understand that and say, here's how it compares to biblical truth, and here's how we can understand these ideas kind of coexisting. So Thomas Aquinas was a very key figure in that. And then kind of the last piece during this time, and why it's kind of known as kind of the golden age of Christianity, is that there was also a huge shift in church architecture. Church architecture up to this point had largely been Romanesque, which basically meant kind of lower, shorter church buildings than what we maybe think of today when we think of cathedrals. Small windows, really big, thick stone buildings, arches, certainly, but nothing like super tall. In the 12th century, or in the 13th century here in the 1200s, you suddenly see people start to figure out new styles of architecture and new ways of supporting buildings and building things. And that's when you get the rise of like beautiful Gothic cathedrals that are just soaring in height, huge, tall, slender windows, major revolution of architecture that its influence is still being felt today, for sure. That was, you know, an architectural revolution that happened in service of the Christian church. So all of that was going on kind of in the 13th century. Then in the 14th and 15th centuries, it kind of all fell apart again. So again, we're seeing a lot of ebbs and flows as we go through all this. So the 14th and 15th centuries led to a really significant collapse of the Pope's authority after things like nationalism and war and plague and corruption and invasion happened. So as trade was developing, like I talked about with the Crusades, a monetary economy kind of resumed. Like I said earlier, when things kind of fell apart after Charlemagne, people went to barter economy. Now in the 14th and 15th century, it kind of came back to a monetary economy. And that led to wider support for stronger kings and more centralized power. So now during the 14th and 15th centuries, you see more consolidation of areas to support one particular king. So we have a king here, we have a king over here, and it's a lot more centralized power. These kingdoms kind of especially developed stronger monarchies in places like France, England, and Scandinavia. Around this time, nationalism also became really prominent. Previous to this era, people would often identify with the cities or the regions that they lived in. Now they started to identify more with the kingdom. I'm French, I'm English or British. So that kind of was a really interesting change because that led people away from necessarily identifying with the church. And so because people were identifying with these nations and with these kings, they were less interested in what the Pope had to say or in what the church had to say. So the church and the Pope kind of started dwindling in power to some extent as well. Another major thing that happened started in 1347, so midway through the 14th century. The Great Plague, the bubonic plague, the Black Death, has a lot of different names. Call it what you will. This lasted for a couple, the worst of it lasted for a couple of years, and it killed off about a third of the population. So roughly one out of three people died. It was devastating. We understand a little bit of this, having just come through a pandemic. This was far worse. It was far worse. It disrupted economies. Again, feels familiar, but it disrupted economies. It created a lot of political turmoil, and it created riots. A lot of people got more superstitious. Part of the superstition came from wondering how are some people getting sick but not others. People had different ideas of witchcraft, or maybe this person's safe because of this or that. And so things got really weird and people got really superstitious about things. This was also an era where anti-Semitism increased a lot. A lot of Christians seemed to think that Jewish peoples were not getting infected and not dying at as high of a rate as Christians. And so some Christians, in many cases, blamed Jewish populations for the plague. The reality of that was probably that Christians at a lot of time had superstitions about cats being involved with witchcraft, and so Christian areas of town often had fewer cats in them, whereas Jewish peoples did not have that superstition about cats, and so they did have more cats in their parts of town. And those cats would eat mice and kill the mice, and those mice were the ones that were actually spreading the plague. And so that just kind of helps us understand how some of this anti-Semitism was evolving. And, you know, anti-Semitism, of course, persists in different forms today, but that's the form that it took at that time. There was also a lot of death of younger children. Today, we understand that's probably because kids yet had not fully, did not have as well developed immune systems as adults did. So the plague really disproportionately impacted children. And that was really devastating, of course, to anyone involved. So the plague had huge ramifications that set Europe back, well, it set most of the world back by several centuries, just because so many people died. It took so long to kind of rebuild to where things had been previous to that. So then by 1453, so midway through the 15th century, the Byzantine Empire did eventually fall to the Ottoman Empire, an area of Turkey that was led by a Muslim army. So at that time, Constantinople was renamed to Istanbul, and that name, Istanbul, still stays today. But that's when the Byzantine Empire finally fell apart and was no more. That's not to say the Christian church never stopped existing in those regions. It did, but the Byzantine Empire was no more, similar to how the Roman Empire basically no longer existed either. Also during this time, and it's a really long, complicated story that I don't fully understand and we don't have time to delve into, but there became a political division where the Pope had to flee, basically, from Rome because he got in trouble with local authorities in Rome. He fled. The Pope fled to Avignon in France, and so there became, you know, a line of popes that were there. But then at the same time, there came to be a separate line of popes that were in Rome. So we had two separate lines of popes that were kind of competing for power and saying, "I'm the Pope. No, I'm the Pope. I'm the Pope." And they were fighting over it. It became hugely controversial. A lot of people were mad at each other. Again, it was an instance of the church and the state kind of being intertwined in different ways. And there was wars about this, political intrigues. This season became known as the Great Western Schism. Some people also called it the Babylonian Captivity, comparing it to the time when the Israelites were evicted out of Israel by the Babylonian armies. They called it the Babylonian Captivity because they viewed the true Pope, some people viewed the true Pope as being the Pope that was kind of hiding out in Avignon in France. So that was all very complicated. So all in all, right now at this point, towards the end of the 14th and 15th centuries, the church is very divided. It's very enmeshed with political power. There was a lot of corruption in the church and in the state. There were some people who tried to bring about some reforms, so we'll talk about that. There was a movement called the Conciliar Effort that tried to resolve this problem of having two separate popes. At one point, the solution was a third pope, because it said both of these popes can't be the pope because they're fighting, so let's choose a different pope. That didn't work. Other solutions didn't work. But by 1449, they finally resolved the issues and got back to having one pope in Rome. Took a while, but they finally got to that. Along the same time, a lot of people were really starting to see that the church was really, really straying from the Bible. They were seeing the power and wealth that the church was accumulating and how it was often being done at the expense of the people. So that was really just setting a lot of tension and people kind of realizing, I don't think this is what Christianity is supposed to be, what's going on here. One of the early reformers was named John Wycliffe. You may have heard of him. He was doing his work in the late 1300s, and so the end of the 14th century. He was a really key figure, and he saw how the church was exerting too much political power, and he wanted more of the authority to be back in the church amongst the people and not in specific singular leaders. He was also a major advocate for translating scripture into the native language of various peoples. So he was one of the early key figures of getting the Bible translated into the English language at the time. Efforts to translate languages in native tongues continue today by Wycliffe Ministries. So his name is still on ministries that are still translating the gospel into other languages today. So hugely influential person. Another guy who was influential was named John Huss. He was kind of ministering in the late 1300s, early 1400s. He was very critical of popes that followed their own interests. He went so far as to say they're not really a pope if they're serving their own interests and not really obeying the Bible. He was very critical of indulgences. Indulgences were... So in the church at the time, there was a major practice of purgatory where a person who maybe didn't have complete faith, I don't understand it very well, but a person would maybe, if they died, they would maybe go to purgatory instead of going straight to hell or straight to heaven. And in purgatory, they would kind of pay for their sins. People who were living, the church taught, could buy indulgences. So if you had a loved one who died and you thought would maybe be in purgatory, you could buy indulgences. And the idea was that would lessen the time the person spends in purgatory so that they could go to heaven sooner. Obviously, this is nowhere in the Bible, so this indulgence thing was just a corrupt money grab by the church. A lot of controversy over this. John Huss was one of the people who was advocating against that. He became very critical about this, and he was eventually burned at the stake as a heretic in 1415. But his views lived on, and people kind of still said, no, this needs to stop. We need to, you know, follow his example. Another reformer by the name of Girolamo Savonarola was in Florence in Italy, and he also critiqued the powerful and their love of luxury, even though there was tremendous poverty around. He said, there are too many people in the church that have too much power and too much wealth. They're not doing anything to help the community. This is a corruption of the church. He was also executed as a heretic. So really problematic stuff going on where people who were trying to get back to scripture and back to the gospel were being persecuted and eventually killed for that. So a really, really bad time for the church in terms of corruption and just not being faithful to scripture. Also during this time in the 14th and 15th centuries, we get the emergence of the Renaissance and humanism. So the Renaissance, I'm sure we've all heard of, is kind of a renewal and a rebirth of art and thought that was kind of stemming from antiquity. So it was kind of saying, oh, let's look back at the Greeks and what a beautiful society created. So let's have our art imitate their art and sculpture, bring back some of their philosophy. And it was also a major push into like scientific thought and thinking and such things. Humanism was the development of this idea that advocates that humans are the center of the universe and like everything has to be measured in human terms. So really put the human at the forefront as opposed to anything supernatural or spiritual. Those ideas were developing during this time. Another major development that cannot be understated is in 1413, so beginning-ish of the 15th century, a guy named Gutenberg invented the Gutenberg Press, which made it possible for the first time to mass-produce literature. So it was the first time you could mass-produce newspapers, books, papers, all kinds of those things. That revolutionized everything because it made books and learning and knowledge so much more accessible than it had previously been. Obviously, everything by then, before then, had to be crafted by hand, which is very time-consuming and possibly leads to errors. A major development that the Gutenberg Press enabled was because you could now suddenly mass-produce books, a lot of Christian scholars got together and they looked at all the different like handmade copies of Christian texts of the Bible, and they said, oh, look, this copy says this, this copy says this, this one says this. There may be some errors, and so they were in this time able to reconcile those errors so that when they mass-produce copies, the new copies were much more accurate and faithful to the original texts. So that is a lot of history that we just covered. So thank you so much for listening if you got this far. The next episode will not go into quite as much of a time period. So that was a really, really, you were learning from a fire hose. So if you didn't retain everything, that's okay. So I'm going to call it there. Thank you so much for watching or listening. If you have any questions, please let me know. My email address is listed in the show notes down below. Thank you and have a wonderful and blessed day.